Welcome to the Not Nate Ever Podcast. I'm Jamie Smith, and joining me this week are Kevin, James, and Natalie is back showing her face on the podcast, despite the fact we won without her being on last week. 2-0 win for Burnley at Turf Moor on Monday Night Football in front of the Sky cameras and under the new floodlights at Turf Moor. Goals from Jeff Hendrick and Michael Keane sealed a very comfortable home win for Burnley, a second home win of the season, and the Clarets are up to 13th in the league table, so all is well. James, very, very good performance. I've seen people saying it's the best we've seen in 2-3 years. Do you think it was that good?
Yeah, it's definitely the best performance we've seen this term, but I mean, we've had some really good performance in the last 2-3 years. I think particularly first half promotion, we were quite dominant for large periods of the season. But, you know, it was a very good performance. I think we're still just lacking a little bit in that sort of finishing touch. There's, you know, a few opportunities that really you'd like to see us take advantage of in the Premier League. And, you know, on another day where maybe we don't create the same volume of chances, you'd come to regret not taking them.
I'd say it was definitely our most accomplished Premier League performance. I don't think, even when it was 0-0, I think we were all very confident. Certainly I was very confident we were going to win the match. I think we were very Watford, obviously nowhere near some of the standards they've shown so far this season. But I don't think you can take credit away from us either. I thought we were very professional. We played very well, and I was confident at 0-0, very confident at 1-0. And as soon as the second goal went in, Watford might as well have just packed up and gone home.
Yeah, I think Watford were very poor. I think it's always a difficult balance when a team's particularly bad, because it's partly our performance made them play badly, but they were also just bad, I think. Not quite the same as the Liverpool game, where we were under quite a bit of pressure but held them at arm's length. Watford were just rubbish and didn't really create anything. Until the first goal came, though, Burnley dominated the game without creating an awful lot. Do you think that's still a bit of an issue, or do you think it was fine chance creation?
I think we have to be mindful of it. We've said on many occasions before, and it's very well documented, that the number and volume of chances that you're given in the Premier League is a lot less than you get in the Championship. And you have to be much more clinical in front of goal if you're going to convert those chances to goals. We've seen it this season that we have retained quite a bit of possession but not really done anything with it. And I think we were better at that last night. I certainly felt we were more positive, and we looked more, a little bit more clinical going forward. We certainly looked more positive on the attack. But I think we all, certainly towards the end, coming up to the goal towards the end of the half, we all said, you know, we have to score, we have to make this count. So many times, the most recent example of that I can give is the Swansea game, for opening game of the season. We felt like we dominated so much of the possession, and we felt we were the better side, and they didn't create an awful lot but just sat back, got their first real attempt and scored a goal. And you get punished like that in the Premier League if you're not careful. So I think the message from me last night was much more improved, much more positive, and they are getting to the stage where they are getting the ball and immediately thinking about trying to get it forward for an attack. But it is still something that they need to be mindful of and try and make some improvements.
Yeah, I think the mindset and the aggression was a lot better last night. There was much more positive intent, like you say, whenever we got the ball. A much different game to the Liverpool one as well, when obviously we were soaking up pressure, playing on the break a lot more. Watford were inviting us onto them, and we got a lot of crosses into the box as well. Good crosses in particular from Goodmunson, who I felt had a very good game. And I think getting crossed into the box was something that a lot of people wanted to see. In terms of formation, though, James, we all talked about the 4-5-1 last week, and we all thought it was going to be back to 4-4-2. Patrick Bamford into the team. Dash stuck with the 4-5-1, and it looked completely different to how it did at Leicester. Do you think maybe Leicester was a bit of a practice for this game? Dash was testing it out?
Potentially. I think, you know, when you change formation, you know, you don't know how long they've had chance to work on it on the training pitch. I think sort of as a midfield unit, we were a lot better last night, and I think that was really key to what we did. You know, it wasn't like Volks was isolated the same way Gray is. Gray's looking for balls over the top, whereas Volks is happy to turn and face his midfielders and sort of pick it up, hold it up, flick it on. And I thought a really big point was just how much better George Boyd was in general. I mean, he still didn't really offer enough creativity, but his running was a lot more purposeful, and it actually looked like he was achieving something with the pressure he's putting on, rather than just, you know, clocking up the miles.
Yeah, the thing I've got with Boyd, he was good last night, and he was good against Liverpool. I think he always, it's one of these who looks better in a good team performance, first of all. I think when the team's struggling, he finds it hard to impact the game. But I think it was also the sort of match that suits him, where that running will force mistakes because the opposition aren't up to that much. But yeah, creatively, there was still not enough for me from Boyd. There were also a couple of moments where, defensively, although he did more than enough running, there were a couple of poor defensive headers. Fair enough, it's not exactly his game, but he almost put us into trouble a couple of times. A couple of tackles on the edge of his own box weren't great, but overall, certainly a massive improvement for Boyd. The one player who was obviously the difference maker, though, Natalie, took the sponsors' man of the match, was again Stephen Defoe, who continues to look just a class above.
Doesn't he? Just what a signing. I still keep looking at him and just think, how have we got this guy? Where's he come from? And I think we've been a little critical times about the club's international scouting policy and how some international players haven't really worked for us, despite coming with a lot of promise and a lot of fanfare. I certainly don't think that we can make that claim with Defoe. He looks like the kind of player that just comes out of nowhere and suddenly is a real star in the Premier League size. Look at Payet, is it Payet or Payet? I don't know how to pronounce it, at West Ham. He sort of came out of nowhere. And it's that kind of player that you unearth some quality in the Premier League and he suddenly grabs the headlines. And I can genuinely see Defoe being one of those players. I don't think I've ever seen a Burnley player with that level of class in a Burnley shirt before. I don't know about you guys, but I just can't think of somebody who matches that talent.
Yeah, it's difficult to talk about without getting hyperbolic, sort of a handful of games in someone's career, but the home performances we've seen from Defoe, they've just been different class, and the quality of the delivery for the two goals last night, I think that's a big difference from 2 years ago. We talked on the podcast either last week or the week before about things that are different, and I think one thing that is different is that we have Defoe's ability on set pieces, his crossing ability, his decisiveness. I think he's elevated the midfield to a whole new level, and I think the injury problems he had earlier in his career have certainly done us a favour, because there's no way we'd have got him if he hadn't missed a whole season through problems earlier in his career when it looked like he was about to sign for Manchester United. But Kevin, picking individuals like is almost unfair from such a good team performance. You could almost make a case for all the team to be man of the match last night.
You could, yeah. I thought Lawton has had a bit of stick recently. I thought he was much improved. The two central defenders were excellent. Obviously, Keane managed to get a goal as well. Jamie, you wouldn't forgive me if I didn't mention Ward. I thought Goodmanson was very good as well. I think he's been underwhelming at best so far in his Burnley career. But I thought he was much improved and quite impressive. Impressive last night. Vaux was a much more effective lone striker than Andrew Gray was and probably ever will be. I'm not really sure why Dyche decided to play Gray up front by himself in the last match, but Vaux looks much more natural at that, and I think he then allowed the rest of the team to come forward, and I think Hendrick was a lot more impressive, being the most advanced advanced midfielder as well. And just the it was a real teal performance. Obviously, Defoe was going to grab the headlines because of those fantastic deliveries that he delivered. But it really was. There was not a single poor performance throughout the whole match. Even Tom Heaton, who didn't have much to do, produced that fantastic save early in the second half, just before we scored, which was a very, very important contribution from him.
Yeah, that was a key moment in the match, because Watford had started the second half quite well. I think it's probably one that you'd expect him to save, but the fact that we then went down the other end and scored pretty much straight away and put the game to bed just indicated how important that save was, I think. To come back to the shape briefly, Natalie, the 4-5-1, as Kev points out, with Vaux as the focal point instead of Gray, as I'm sure a lot of people would have expected, worked a lot better. Volks held the ball very well, won a lot of balls in the air. And there seems to be quite a good understanding already with Hendrick picking up quite a few knockdowns, Hendrick playing instead of Defoe as the more advanced of the three.
Absolutely. I think you summarised that pretty much spot on, to be honest. It was one of those where, you know, we've all been quite critical of Dyche's inflexibility in the past, and we've all been crying out for something new, especially to take away the predictability of our squad. And it's too easy for teams, especially those with really good coaching staff, they can just watch not very much of our game and know how to counteract it very, very easily. And it makes you very vulnerable to just being wiped out of a game in the Premier League. Dyche, fair enough, it was forced on him with the absence of Andre Gray, but he did do it. He took a leap of faith, changed the formation, and it worked so well. What I think impressed me more than anything out of the formation last night was it looked to me like those players had been playing in those positions with that team for all of their lives. It didn't look new. They looked composed. They all knew what their role was. Everybody knew where everybody was supposed to be. And it didn't look like it was the first time they played that. And I think that was the key for me, I think, to its success.
Yeah, I think you're right. One of the problems at Leicester was that the five in midfield were quite flat, I think. So you don't really get the benefit of having the extra man in there if they're all just in a line. Whereas Hendrick was very clearly playing in front of Defoe and Marnie, and Marnie was very clearly playing behind Defoe. They were very staggered throughout the pitch, so there was always going to be someone between the lines. I think Dean Marnie, we've not really mentioned, but I thought he had a very good game at the back of the midfield, a role that I don't think he's been particularly suited to, but with the protection from Defoe and Hendrick in front of him, he had a very good game and, of course, chased down the lost cause for the corner that we scored the first goal from as well. So, very well played by Dean Marnie, who was the one that a lot of people thought was going to miss out if we'd switched to 4-4-2. James Patrick Bamford, though, sat on the bench, unused substitute. A lot of people just assumed he was going to come into the team for Gray, and he must be thinking, if I'm not going to get a chance now, when am I going to get a chance? Are you a bit surprised that Dyche didn't use him at all last night, even when the game was won?
Yeah, I was really surprised to see him not come on, because I thought that, you know, maybe late on when we're under a lot of pressure, while obviously Volks' aerial ability is really useful for clearing
Volks,
the box.
Volks also picked up a knock at one point as well, so I was really surprised and just bring him off for a bit of protection.
And I mean, he's not the quickest of lads, but I mean, he's not slow, but he's not, you know, he's not someone you expect to really do a lot of pressing when you're under pressure. And I thought he would have brought Bamford on just for that, you know, fresh legs, really press the ball carrier, which is, you know, obviously what we do with the midfield. Because I think that's, you know, other than time wasting as well, that's probably why Carty came on, you know, fresh legs, someone who can basically just run at whoever's got the ball. So I think it was surprising, but we've not really seen a lot of him. So I don't know whether he's maybe not impressed in training or, you know, there's something else that means he's not quite the right fit at the moment. But I mean, I'd be really surprised if we didn't see him at all, you know, in his loan spell, because, you know, he's come with the expectation that he's going to, you know, get a look in at least.
Sorry, I'm just laughing at the dog in the background. We're going to have another repeat of the podcast when James got chased by a dog.
Let's hope so.
That dog is actually really, really far away. I can't even see where it is.
I am also quite concerned that Natalie's going to conk out during the podcast because she's evidently not very well.
Jamie's going to be the end of the podcast. It's just going to be me and Jamie.
Taking us off slowly but surely. It's been nice for all listeners. It's been fun while it lasted.
But going back to football, I think on Bamford, it's an interesting, tricky one, because I've seen a few fans saying that he's of other clubs saying that he's not very physically strong, which probably suggests that he's not hugely well suited to a 4-5-1, which in turn probably is one of the reasons he's maybe had not as much of a chance in the Premier League, because a lot of Premier League teams tend to set up with that one top striker. And yeah, it's so that's probably a reason why he didn't come on last night. I mean, I wonder what he's thinking right now, because we know that he's not very happy when he's not playing football. He terminated his own loan last season. And this purely from his. I mean, I'm glad we played the 4-5-1. It worked very well. Purely from a Burnley perspective, I think it was very good. Thinking of what Bamford might be thinking himself, he probably thinking this is he's not going to get a better opportunity to come into the team all season. With literally, he's playing a team that usually plays 4-4-2. We've got two available strikers, and he only plays one of them. Obviously, Dyche is a player that, I imagine, it doesn't change his team that often. He rarely makes early subs. Bamford's going to be looking at players like his Chelsea teammate, Nathan Chalobah, who obviously came to Burnley when we didn't have many central midfielders and didn't get a game. I'm wondering, is that going to happen to me again? So it will be interesting to see how Dyche approaches this for the rest of, certainly until January.
It is a strange one. I mean, no criticism of Dyche on this, because he stuck with the 4-5-1 when a lot of people telling him not to, and it worked, so all credit to Dyche for that. But I think there is a chance that Bamford gets disillusioned here, because, as Kev says, he's a player that threw his toys out of the Prem a little bit at Crystal Palace when he wasn't getting games last year. This, everyone assumed, was going to be Bamford's chance. I assumed he was going to play last night. And it felt like a snub to me for him not even to come on for a talking last 10 minutes, last 5 minutes, when we were under very little pressure. The game was won. We're seeing it out comfortably. Just to stretch his legs, it felt like a snub to me, which suggests it's something, maybe something beyond the scenes, behind the scenes, even beyond the scenes isn't a thing, behind the scenes that we just don't know about. So that'll certainly be one to keep an eye on. I assume we're going to stick with 4-5-1, certainly against Arsenal now, if not for the rest of Gray's suspension, which makes it difficult to see where Bamford's going to get in. Really, we did a poll on Twitter actually just before the game asking it was which formation we think Dyche was going to go with, not what we do, what Dyche was going to do, and 75% said it'd be 4-4-2, so just shows what everyone on Twitter knows, I suppose. Talking about Bamford then takes us in nicely to Andre Gray, which we obviously have to mention on the podcast, because he got a 4-match ban for the social media posts that we all know about, came out after the Liverpool game. A lot of fans think 4 games is a bit extreme. Some people think he's maybe lucky to have not got more. Very difficult issue, of course. We've done it on the podcast before. But talking purely about the punishment, Natalie, 4 games, do you think that's about right? Do you think it's harsh? What's your view?
I have two ways to think about this. I think if we look at this in the context of Andre Gray and what he did and his punishment as an individual, then I feel that 4-match ban was fair. I think it was a serious enough offence. I'm still pretty disgusted with the tweets that he made, to be honest. And whilst obviously he is a Burnley player and he does get my support, it has made me think about him slightly different until such a point that he does prove that he has changed as a person. So I think, looking at him as an individual, I think it was an appropriate punishment. I think it had to be harsh because it reflects the severity of his offence. On the flip side of that, the inevitable knock-on of a ban for a player. So obviously, the FA look at it and they've banned the player. They've stopped him from earning his trade. They've put, it's obviously a blemish on his professional character, and they feel like they're punishing him as an individual. An inevitable knock-on of that is that it does affect the club that he plays for, and it does feel particularly harsh because he wasn't a player with us at the time that he made the tweets. So I completely understand some of the Burnley fans upset that they feel that actually the club's been punished rather than the player. I don't think that's the case, and I think Kevin, I'm sure we'll come on to in a moment, can put this much more eloquently than I can, and it's a balance between being affected by a punishment and being punished by a punishment. So yes, I accept that it's incredibly frustrating for us as a club that we have also been affected by a ban for an individual because of the actions of him, but I do think it was fair. One thing I would like to say, actually, and this is the last I'm going to say on this, because I don't particularly want to get embroiled in social media arguments with people, but I saw quite a lot of campaign on social media before the game that they were going, that certain selection of fans were going to voice their support for Andre during the game, and on the 7th minute, which obviously Andre's squad number, there was a small selection of supporters who started chanting in support of Andre, but the words they chose to to chant where he tweets what he wants on the seventh minute and chanting his name. I think as fans, we need to be very careful here. I certainly don't condone that sort of behaviour, and I did not join in that chant. And I think we have to be very careful here that we don't dismiss or dilute the seriousness of his offence here. Making a joke of it and showing his support is just not an appropriate response to an offence of this nature. And I don't think it looks particularly good on us as fans. I think at the point that Andre, whatever action he chooses to do now, the point that he demonstrates that he is a changed man and he is genuinely sorry, as opposed to just words that say, I'm sorry, I'm changed. When he demonstrates that, then we can back him as a player and we can back him as one of ours and say, you know, great, we support you because you've shown that you've changed and that you're a changed person. Until that point, I think we need to be very, very careful here as to how we show that support.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the chant, people probably just thought, oh, we'll do something to support Andre, not really thinking about what they'd actually done. But what they've done is said, it's fine to say all gay people should burn and die, which I'm sure was not their intention, but that's actually what they did. So, yeah, I don't want to particularly do it. There was also Isaac Success, the Watford substitute. They were saying, you're just a bleep acting bae, which... it's funny, but you can't really say a black person looks like another black person just because they're black. That's not really a thing you should do. And to come back to Andre Gray, Kev, obviously, you've spoken about this in quite a lot of detail. You've done a couple of articles on it, but can you just sum up the arguments against why it's not a punishment against Burnley? Because I think that's what a lot of people have fixated on, the fact that it does seem to punish Burnley more than it punishes Andre Gray.
I mean, so I wrote something this week, which probably some people have seen. If not, I could probably put a link in the show notes, something that'll boost my profile. I mean, some people have said some of the arguments, such as, you know, it was four games is excessive. But actually, when you look at some previous bans for things like this, so Coventry defender Chris Stokes got a one-match ban for tweeting something which was certainly nowhere near as extreme as Gray's. So that's a one-match ban for one offence, whereas Gray was charged on six offences and got four matches. Similarly, a non-league player got a 15-match ban for nine breaches. So, it's... in terms of precedent, there's certainly precedent there to say that Gray's even been treated leniently, perhaps. I think, like Natalie said, I think there's a very important distinction between Burnley being punished and Burnley being affected. And the latter hasn't happened. The former hasn't happened. The latter has happened. The punishment is very clearly on Andre Gray, whereas Burnley are purely affected by it. And I think it's very important that we don't take kind of club context into consideration too much. I mean, I think it's the same as any offence. If I do something while I'm in one job, move to another employer, and it gets reported to the police, and I have to do community service or time in jail or something, I have to take time off my current employer. I wasn't at that job at the time, but it's my current employer is affected by it. I think it's a similar-ish situation. You could also say, some people say that the club's done nothing wrong, completely wrong to have them affected. But at the end of the day, Burnley should have been aware of these tweets. And that's not to say that we should have done anything differently. It's not to say that we wouldn't have signed him, but it's just to say that we should have been aware that there was a risk that at some point in the future, a skeleton could come out and it could affect them in some way. And that would, that's essentially the club's responsibility. And if they weren't aware of that, then the onus is on them, essentially. I think there were a few arguments against the ban, but I've not been convinced in any way by any of them at all, to be honest.
Yeah, I think one of the things I'd like to... I don't want to go on about this loads, because we are going to do a special podcast about Andre Gray's tweets and homophobia in football generally that will be out in a couple of weeks or so. We've got various interviews booked in. But one of the things people have said is that the club should have done due diligence, which... sounds like this fantastic catch-all easy fix, but raises more questions than answers for me, James. If they do due diligence and say they find these tweets before they sign Andre Gray, do they then still sign him? Do they punish him? I don't understand where the due diligence would have fitted in had they found these tweets. What should the club have then done?
That's a really good point, actually. I hadn't thought about that previously, but you know, if they find something like that and they say, well, we'll only sign you if you delete it, are they covering it up? Should they?
I think so. A lot of people report it, or a lot of people have suggested that deletion is basically like, it's fine. If they've gone, it doesn't cover it up. Gray should surely still be punished for something he's done. The fact that the tweets have gone doesn't mean that he didn't do it.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that approach previously, but no, I think it, you know, you can't sweep that kind of thing under the rug. So, you know, if you did find it, is it, you know, morally right, ethically right to just delete it and, you know, never bring it up? Probably not. But it's a difficult one because I know some people said, oh, it's easy just to search keywords and get them up. But, you know, obviously one of the tweets they found when he was at Brentford, how many of us would have picked that out as, you know, a key term to search? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of those things you could put in like hundreds of words and still something could slip through because, you know, it could be context-based. You might not even use an offensive term. You might just, you know, combine the sentence is offensive. It's really difficult. I mean, I think what I said to someone the other day was maybe the best way is just as soon as you sign up, away you say you have to, you know, clear every tweet you've got on your account and start again because, you know, we're not going to go through and look at it. But at the same time, we don't want to be punished if, you know, past indiscretions on your Twitter are found. So it's time for a clean slate.
I think there are two points here. One, I think due diligence doesn't have to be actively searching for things. I think particularly for tweets like this, Andrew Gray must have known that he had tweeted some things in the past that could have been seen as controversial and could potentially prove problems. I'm not saying that he's aware of specific things he's tweeted, but he's very clearly acknowledged that he's a very different person back then. Surely he knew that he was on Twitter at the time and there was potentially things on there that could have been controversial. All it takes is the club to have that conversation with him when he comes in, ask him, is there something there that we need to look at? Maybe, and if he says yes, maybe then you do something to look at it. But if he says no, I'm 100% sure there's nothing there. Yeah, I think there's no argument for searching through a tweet then, but I'm sure Gray must have known there was potentially something there that could be objectionable. And I think the second thing is, If then we do go and find the tweets, I'm not saying we should do something differently. I think, yeah, we probably should delete them, but purely so that they don't come up and then cause the problems this has. But I don't think it's about covering it up, or I don't think it's about not signing him or anything like that. I think it's purely just that responsibility. I think it comes down to the ban. I've said that we can't complain about the ban because we should have known about it and taken that into consideration when we signed him. We should have signed him with the knowledge that there was potentially something going to come up in the future that could cause problems. So I don't think it's necessarily about doing anything different. I think it's purely a counter to the argument that it's nothing to do with us, that we should have been aware of it and should have been aware that there was potentially a problem that could happen down the line.
I think that pretty much wraps that one up. As I say, we will go into this in more detail, speak to various people about LGBT issues in football on a future podcast, so do look out for that. Just to wrap this little bit of the podcast up, Natalie, in terms of the actual football, a lot of people were concerned that Gray was going to be a big miss, even though he's not touched the ball recently because the service has been very poor. But the win over Watford indicates that we might just do okay without him.
Yeah, I think we'll be fine. I know Andre's a really key player for us, and prior to the signings we made in this transfer window, he was our record signing. You know, that comes with responsibility, and it does also reflect the talent of that particular individual. So I think it's naive to say that we won't miss him at all when he's gone, because he can flit in and out of games. But actually, you know, when he's got the right service, he can be incredibly dangerous as a player, and he can create chances out of nothing. What I think last night just reinforced to me is that we aren't a one-man team. And actually, that team spirit and that work ethic that squad has had and has had for a good few years now is still there. It hasn't been diluted by the presence of a star striker, and it hasn't been overridden by some potential inflexibility of tactics. That, you know, those lads will play for each other. They will do what they are told to do, and they will work for the good of the team. And I think that was really positive to see.
Yeah, I think there's also a chance that the ban works in our favour a little bit. The players will be determined to show that we can cope without Andre, but also to do it for him because he's not able to be out there with them. Also, Dash, I think, has spoken out and basically said he doesn't agree with the ban. So it's possibly... A lot of clubs seem to... Smaller clubs thrive when things are going against them. A lot of fans have talked about almost it being a conspiracy against Burnley, but sometimes that can work if you build this sort of idea up that everyone's against us, everyone wants us to fail. It increases a bit of determination and motivation, so interesting to see if that has an impact as well. But I'm sure, on the flip side, everyone wants Andre Gray back playing for Burnley as soon as possible, so hopefully we'll get through the next few games okay, and he'll be back in the team. We'll preview Arsenal at the end of the podcast, but if Natalie's voice is up to it, we'll crack on with Tweet of the Week next.
Tweet of the Week, Tweet of the Week. Tweet of the Week, Tweet of the Week. Tweet of the Week, Tweet of the Week, Tweet of the Week.
Indeed, do not fret. Nothing will keep me away from Tweet of the Week.
She's back, she's back.
I'm back, yay. This week's Tweet of the Week is just a nice little simple positive summary of last night's game. It's by Phil Hitch. It summarises pretty much what we all thought and tweeted about after the game last night. And he says, great performance all round, which it was, Defoe class again, which he was, and just how bright are those new floodlights. So I really liked that tweet because it summarised what we all thought. So well done, and thank you for that.
I'm glad everyone's had a chance to experience the floodlights, because we talked about the floodlights in some detail when they were unveiled. Someone say far too much detail. I don't think there was enough detail.
They did warrant that detail, though. They were pretty spectacular.
James, very impressive, these floodlights. I know you like the engineering on show. That was incredibly bright.
I think we're going to have to revisit that design document that we covered previously, because
there will also be a special,
you know, we've now got evidence to, evidence to put to the numbers, so I think, you know, we could delve a bit deeper, but it was like it was just so uniform. It was incredible, wasn't it? It was just like
it made the turf look really different light. As well. Did you not think? I mean,
it's like watching a model. Like a model village.
It did. Turf's always been absolutely outstanding under the floodlights anyway, but last night it just went up another level. I loved it.
The really impressive thing was how little leakage there was. Like, it was only the pitch that was lit. It wasn't like the back of the bob board or anything. Really impressive. Impressive work.
I think a lot of people will be hoping that, obviously, we play Sunday afternoon, 4 o'clock kickoff, something, half four even against Arsenal. So hopefully it's a nice dark day, get the floodlights on. Maybe stick some sort of big tarp over the turf so that it's nice and dark and we can have the floodlights on. We always seem to do better under the lights. I don't know if the stats back that up or not.
I'd be quite interested to see that, actually, if somebody's got any stats. I'm sure somebody somewhere must have done that.
There was one time, I think, when Dash first came in and we had a really bad run at home, I think there were a few defeats midweek. But before that, we definitely had a very strong record at home, midweek evenings, when the floodlights were on. I don't know if it's the case now, because we did have a few bad results when Dash first came in, but it always feels a bit more special when the lights are on. So delay the kick-off against Arsenal, I reckon. Kick-off about 6:30, just after sunset. That'd be perfect for me. Moving on to the Arsenal game then. Arsenal in pretty good form. They've obviously got Champions League game this week, but since they lost to Liverpool on the opening day, they have been very impressive, extremely impressive against Chelsea. But we've already shown that we can compete with good teams. Liverpool have been outstanding since we beat them, so Burnley at home, surely we can be positive about this one, Kevin. We've got a chance against anyone on our own turf.
Yeah, so obviously the Liverpool game showed that on our day at the turf in front of our home fans, we can be a match for anybody. We can really up our game. Obviously, we had a very good victory against Arsenal quite a few years ago now. It was a Kevin McDonald double in the cup at Turf Moor. That was a fantastic game. And yeah, particularly, like you said, I think if a team are fired up, it'd be interesting to see what Sean Dyche does in terms of shape and tactics. But yeah, obviously, you're never going to say that we're favourites. You're never going to say we're going to be expecting to get anything out of it. But I'd say there's certainly a good chance of us getting at least a point.
Before the Leicester game, James, we talked about their Champions League game being a benefit for us. That didn't really work out this way. But some teams do struggle on the back of a Champions League game. Arsenal are at home to Basel, I think, on Wednesday. I think so. They've not got a long trip, but two games in a week always means there could be some rotation. It won't necessarily be their strongest team we see on Sunday.
Yeah, potentially. No, I'd be surprised if Wenger sees another Premier League team as someone to rest players against. But it's going to be a tough game because obviously Arsenal are in early season Arsenal form, which means they look like a title challenger until about March. So really, we would like to home a game against them probably later in the season when you've got a better chance to win. But see, first time round, we're in the Premier League. We were really lucky to not beat them, and you know, we should have done if that Stephen Fletcher goal hadn't been wrongly judged offside. But I just feel like we step up a bit more for the big sides at home. So you know, I think there's every chance we can create an upset.
James is right there, isn't he? Now the last couple of times we've been in the Premier League, we do seem to play better against the perceived stronger team, so surely that's something that stands in our favour for this one.
Yeah, I really do think so. And actually, out of all of the stronger teams in the division, Arsenal's probably one that you want in that situation. It's probably one that we stand more of a chance with. As James quite rightly pointed out, you know, Arsenal are currently in their perceived world-beating form that they are in the beginning of the season. But they're also one of the most frustratingly inconsistent teams in the league. And they've just come out of the back of a fantastic result against Chelsea, and probably an unexpected result against Chelsea as well. They're likely to have some Champions League success as well. It would be so very Arsenal to come to Burnley on Sunday and get turned over. So I'm actually genuinely feeling very positive about Sunday. I think we've got a good record against Arsenal at Turf. They're one of the big sides that we don't seem to look intimidated against and seem to actually play quite well against. So I'm feeling relatively positive.
So I was going to say, I think coming in after a good win is an interesting point, because obviously that's what Watford did as well. And potentially, you know, we could catch them unaware, as we perhaps did Watford.
Yeah, that's true.
Although it didn't really work against Leicester after their Champions League result, did it? That kind of went against us. So.
I think the other thing about Arsenal is that they're very patient, but I think we'll sit quite deep, almost like we'll approach it like we did the Liverpool game. Obviously, we got the early goal against Liverpool, which meant that we could sit deep and defend and soak up the pressure. But if we want to sit tight and soak up as much Arsenal pressure as we can and stay in the game as long as possible, and the longer we do that, I think they could become a bit frustrated. We'll round off with predictions as ever. And James's battery is about to die, so we better go to him first. James, give us a prediction for Burnley Arsenal at the Turf on Sunday, please.
I'm going to say we're going to nick it. 2-1. Both goals from Sam Vokes.
Nice. I'm quite positive, actually. I think we might get a point. I'm not confident enough to predict a win, but then I only thought we were going to draw against Watford and we won that game, so shows what I know. Kevin, over to you, give us a prediction.
I think I feel the same as you, Jamie. I think I feel there's certainly reason to be positive for this one, although I'm not going to be as bold as to say we're going to beat one of the big teams like that, although it certainly wouldn't write it off. But I'm going to go for a 1-0 draw, and obviously Stephen Defoe is going to be involved in the goal somehow.
Yeah, just the one goal of the five we've scored this season that Defoe hasn't been involved with, which was the opener against Liverpool. So, yeah, very very big impact from Stephen Defoe. Lastly then, Natalie, I'm guessing the reverse psychology is back with your return to the podcast.
Did you miss it last week when
no,
I was...
No, not really.
I've got to say that I've got 100% record with the reverse psychology now.
That's very true. I also want to point out that Natalie wasn't on the podcast last week and then we won. Coincidence?
And as well, on top of this, I had a real panic last night getting to the ground. I've had the same turnstile since the 2009 promotion season, and I will not deviate from it because I'm really superstitious. which
didn't do much use the two times we got Roger though, did it?
No, okay, I'm glossing over that bit, James.
She's superstitious. She didn't say it works.
Yeah, I know. God, I arrived at turf last night, and there was a massive steward stood like a bouncer right outside my turnstile. I was trying to get in, and went, "You can't come in here." I was like, "What?" And it was broken. All the computers were down, and I was literally pleading with this steward. So we had to go to the next turnstile, and we won. So if reverse psychology fails, I think we might have a backup plan with the new turnstile. But I digress.
Do we not cancel each other out?
Well, this we're going to.
Do you not find it a big detour for away games?
No.
I think that was the perfect reaction, and that's just a sigh.
it was just 2 seconds of silence, which was just magical.
Is your battery not died yet? God.
God, James.
It will go forever on 1%, that's the thing. It just like rapidly goes to 1% and then stays there for an hour.
And how pleased we are at that.
Playing Russian roulette with his battery. I'm hoping he's going to cut off mid-sentence.
Me too. I'm gonna maintain the consistency and see if it works. I've got a bad feeling about Sunday. I think Arsenal will be buoyed by a Chelsea win and a Champions League win, and they're gonna turn us over and we're gonna lose 4-0.
Brilliant. Always end the podcast on a nice positive note. Obviously this week's podcast is a bit late because we played on Monday night, but hopefully we'll have the podcast out Monday, Tuesday as normal next week. Brief thank yous as ever to Natalie, James, Kevin for joining me to the podcast. Thanks to Rick for providing the artwork that we use on social media and on the website. You can always get in touch with any feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, whatever you want to get in touch with, please do. The email address is podcast@nonainever.net. You can also tweet us @nonainevernet. We are still seeking a sponsor. You can get in touch through the same channels if you want to find out more about sponsoring the podcast, which helps us to continue. But that's it for this week. I've been Jamie Smith. Goodbye.
We do, yeah. Obviously, we showed against Liverpool that particularly with the crowd behind us and at home, we can be a match for anybody. Sorry, I just fell off my chair. let me start that again.
Brilliant. So we've had a dog, and Kev fell off his chair, and Natalie's almost died. Very successful podcast.
It's very northern. Just imagine, it's not great, which is unusual.
You're on the coast.
But just imagine, like, very, very lashing wind, flooded roads from the earlier deluge. Very northern, very bleak.
He's so dramatic, Birdie. God.
He's like a Bronte sister, the way he sums up the bleak north.
Hey, promise, when you live on a peninsula, you know what I mean.
When you live on a peninsula.
Oh, God.